Welcome to the Mark and Embark podcast by Scout My Trip. This is your host, Vineet Rajan. A big thank you for all those joining in the No Nonsense podcast about road tripping in India and beyond. Each episode will exclusively dwell deep into destinations on and off the highways, hidden gems, automotive news, road tripping people, and how to road trip smartly. Come, let's mark and embark on a road trip.
Welcome back to another episode of the Mark and Embark podcast. I'm Vineet and it's great to be back. In this episode, we're going to interview a very special person. But before we begin, I have a small request. If somebody shared this podcast with you, do check out our earlier episodes, subscribe to us, like us, and share it further. That's the only way we'll grow, and we'd love your support in this journey of ours. We have a very special guest with us on the show, the one and only Meenakshi Sai, who's back from her Trans-Siberian road trip, Expedi Beyond Asia. This was over many days. We're here to talk about that. We're here to talk about her car, her trips, and what she's planning here on. So without further ado, Meenakshi, welcome to the show. Very excited to have you. And once again, welcome back to India.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be back. Thanks for having me, Vineet. It's lovely talking to you and catching up with you.
Thanks so much, Meenakshi. You're always too kind. But indeed, this has been quite a trip for you. How many days were you on the road?
It was 52 days, Vineet. 52 days. We left from Coimbatore and we reached St. Petersburg on the 52nd day. Yes.
Wow. So could you tell us about this particular trip and the route you took? And let's also talk about the people you traveled with.
All right. So the road trip was scheduled for 52 days and we finished bang on time. I want to quickly say that. There was no delays.
Kudos. And,
thank you. So the route through India was from Coimbatore to Gorakhpur and from there into Nepal and then Kathmandu. We were there for a few days and then to do some paperwork. We'll talk about that later. So once we were done with the paperwork, we went to Tibet, China, and then we drove all around Tibet. We touched Everest Base Camp, a lot of exciting things, and then into mainland China and then into Russia, where we started the formal Trans-Siberian drive from Vladivostok and all the way across Russia to St. Petersburg. So that was the route.
Wow. Really interested to know about your experience in Tibet. How is it there? We hear so much about, you know, what's happening in that particular region. And there is, of course, foreign powers involved. How was it driving through Tibet?
Tibet is extremely beautiful. This is my second time, actually, when I went to Manasarovar. I went, that was like 20 years back. So I don't have much of a memory. But this time around, we drove. So it makes a difference when somebody else is driving and you're driving. You know, you actually drive through the country. So it's extremely beautiful. But people are really, really nice. But there is a tension all the time there. You're completely, on guard there. You have a guide with you. Like, you can't enter Tibet. Any foreigner cannot enter Tibet, even if he's not driving by himself, without a guide. So that's a requirement. You cannot. You get off the plane and there's a guide waiting for you. So you're escorted everywhere. You're watched all the time. And if you give a route, you know, this is what you want to do, and you have to stick by it. You can't really deviate. You know, those things are, they're very rigid on that. And, you know, fortunately for us, we had a Tibetan guide. We got a lot of information from, you know, from his eyes, the way he looks at Tibet. He's quite happy with the way the country is progressing, infrastructure-wise and all that. But then he also told me a shocking thing that I've not heard before or read before. None of the Tibetans who live in Tibet have passports. All their passports have been taken away. They cannot travel out of Tibet. They can go to mainland China with a permit sort of thing, but they can't really leave Tibet or China. They do not have a passport, and that will kill me. And then you feel like we take things for granted, you know, things like this passport, travel. It's nothing. It's just a visa, and then we are on our way. But living in Tibet, you're checked all the time. Even the locals are checked all the time, not just us. But even they are stopped all the time, and they are. It's very difficult. I'm completely with them on it, the way they live. But they are very happy with the infrastructure thing, the healthcare. All that part is quite nice for them. But the only thing that's missing is they don't have freedom to talk or, you know, go where they want to. They have family back in India. A lot of them have family in here.
Yeah.
They cannot come to India, though. And that's a very sad thing. You know, that's something that really bothered me. And so, yeah.
Must have been quite, an experience to have a Tibetan guide.
Exactly. We got really insight into their lives there. You know, we saw, he took us to, you know, homes, you know, you can walk in, and then we saw how they lived. So we saw a lot of Tibet that people don't otherwise see. If you have a Chinese guide, then it's very different. So
yes,
we had a Tibetan guide, so it was good.
So where were you staying in Tibet? Were they hotels or were you staying with people, their homes or?
No, we didn't stay in homes. We're 8 of us. We can't go and, you know, we gatecrash somebody's home. I would personally would love to do that, you know, like stay in people's home. But we were 8 of us, you know, so we can't do that. So we stayed in hotels, basic hotels, nothing, you know, nothing fancy. And some places there are no fancy places as well. So hostels kind of thing. So we stayed in hotels. Throughout the trip, we stayed in hotels. We didn't even do our Airbnb. We just did hotels.
That's great. So you're, in a way, supporting the local economy wherever you're going.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I think that is one very strong aspect about sustainable travel, which I feel we kind of miss out on.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, especially the chain hotels and all. No, we stayed in local places, you know, which are not chains, family-run, you know, hotels, places like that, you know. It was very nice. So that way you get to interact with, you know, the local people. And yeah, Tibet was an eye-opener, I must say.
How was it in Nepal? Last time I went there in 2017. Okay. The entire country was in shambles in terms of the road infrastructure after the earthquake.
Right.
Is it still like that? Has it improved?
It is pretty bad. It's Kathmandu is okay. And from Pokhara, when you drive into Kathmandu, I mean, when you drive into Nepal, you're crossing over into Sanauli border. And then there's Butwal, and then we go to Pokhara. We stayed a day in Pokhara. Pokhara has changed. It's looking better. People have come back. Everybody's, you know, it's the gateway of the Annapurna. The people come there to go trekking. So it's full. It's busy and happening. And that's kind of gotten back to where it looks, I think. Kathmandu as well. But then when we left Kathmandu after 3-4 days towards the border is when we had a lot of trouble with the roads. I mean, there were no roads and the infrastructure was really, really bad. It's still very dusty. The outside of Kathmandu is still the way it is. It's still not gotten together. They've still not fixed it. It's going to take a while, I think.
I mean, they really suffered through that earthquake.
Yeah, but China's offered to make fix their road. So at some point, I think.
So you were there in Nepal for some documentation work, which you wanted to kind of touch upon.
Yes. So if you want to go to Tibet on road, you'll have to do your Chinese visa, which is a group visa in Nepal. You'll have to apply for it there. And it takes, if you fast track it, you get it, or you get it in 3 days. The third day, end of the third day, you get it. So we did all our paperwork there in Nepal. And we reached on a Wednesday. We timed it like, so we reach on a, you know, it has to be a weekday again. So we reached on a Wednesday, put in our papers, and then we got it out on Friday and we left on Saturday. So it takes about 3 days to do your visa and your other permits, your car permit and all that. So that is done in Nepal. If you're entering by road through Nepal, it has to be done. You can't get it ahead. Because the first time around when we entered through another port into China, you can do your visa and then you can just show up there at the border and you're okay. But this is a group visa. So it's very strange that they also told me that the people who enter Tibet have to exit mainland China together. It's a very strange thing that my question was, what if somebody has to leave on an emergency? Then what happens to the group? They said that there is a process, but it takes longer and it can be a pain. And, you know, we might also, all of us have to leave sort of thing, which is very strange. I didn't get the hang of it, but I thought it was a little weird, you know, that people, things can happen. Somebody might have to leave the group and get back home, but they don't have an allowance for that. It's very strange, I thought.
I mean, imagine you had been to Mansarovar also, right?
I've been way long back in 2000. I went, not this trip.
So many Indians go there, push yourself to the limits to kind of complete it.
Right. We saw so many Indians. Looks like it's the second season. So we were in this town called Gelmod. So this full of Indians. You see everywhere and this Indian food. You know, it feels very Indian. It felt like almost being home. It's quite nice, actually. big groups, you know, 50 people, 60 people, a typical one of those, you know, those tour groups with the bags, matching hats, you know, that sort of thing. They're all going to Kailash. I'm like, okay, it's like Sabrimala, you know, when people go. So it's like Kailash, like there are a lot of Indians going, you know. I didn't expect it this time of the year. I thought it would be more in June, July, August, and yeah, but September, they were still there, yeah.
This is really good to hear about your Nepal and Tibet stretch. Anything that, you know, kind of was something you didn't expect in this leg of your journey? Something that just came out of the blue?
We were expecting to do drive to Everest Base Camp, and we did. So Base Camp is not like the one that they have in Nepal where it's a, you know, it's a trek. So this you can actually drive up right up to a point where from that point you take an electric bus. And they put you all in the bus and you can actually drive up. The bus takes you to a point where you see Everest. And that's just something I think that will be the closest I'll get to Everest. And I was completely in awe of it. Only thing is, we're looking at heights. We're looking at 18,000 feet, you know, very high passes. And the weather was bad. That morning, we left at 4:30 in the morning so we could reach there from a place called Tingri. So we could reach Everest Base Camp around 8:39 where the crowds are less. But the thing is, China, they've made it so easy, you know, to get to see Everest up close. While on the Nepal side, you'll have to trek like for a 10-day trek or whatever and then, you know, go through all that. They've just made it so easy. It's very commercial. I was quite shocked. I didn't expect it to be the roads to be so good. I thought Everest Base Camp driving is going to be hard. And I kept asking the guide over the phone before I went. He said, no, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. And I was surprised. The roads were like silk, you know, and you just didn't feel it. We just drove there and got on the bus, which takes you every 10 minutes. People are loaded on the bus and then you go there and you see Everest there. And luckily that day, that morning, the guys who went the previous day, we met some German travelers from some Swedes as well. So they said they couldn't see the peak because the weather was bad and it was just snowing yesterday. So we were so lucky. We got an entire, completely clear view. You should look at some of the pictures. I mean, it's just amazing. And up close, like, and I think that's the closest I'll be getting to Everest. I'm not a trekking person or anything, but it was really, really nice. Fabulous experience, yeah.
You've described it so vividly. So, my question was, and you've answered all this, was how did this kind of compare with the high passes we have in India? But you've answered it really well, saying it's a cakewalk when it comes to, you know,
exactly,
doing something.
Exactly. It's the roads are unbelievable. You know, it's like I want to tell you that, you know, 2 kilometers before Nepal, Kathmandu Rusavgadi, which is 140 kilometers. It's just 140 kilometers. And we took 2 days to get there. The roads are so bad. And the last bit, the last day that we got was 29 kilometers and we drove 8 hours. So we could have actually walked. It was that bad. I was so worried because my car, both the cars are not 4x4s. And we didn't see one other car. Everything was just 4x4. There were Isuzus and there were, all sorts of big vehicles, Prados. And we were in these 2 Tata Hexas and we're looking in. And we actually made it. I didn't think we'll made it. At that point, I didn't think we will make it. You know, it was crazy. And then you cross the border and the roads are like silk. You just have to cross the border. Everything changes. So the difference is stark, like it's blatant, it's in your face. It's crazy the way China is and how we are, Nepal or we are as well.
Yeah. In fact, what you spoke about the cars reminds me of something that, you know, I learned during my biking days.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I ride a Royal Enfield 350cc and it's
nice.
The least powered of all the Royal Enfields around right now.
Right.
And mine also happens to be 10 years old. So there's age also that's kind of catching up.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, and I realize it even now, every day when I, you know, kind of take the bike out or go out on a long trip, it's never the machine, it's the man behind. And I must commend you for this. I'm sure you were driving one of the Hexas.
I was, and my brother was, and another friend. We took turns driving, but my car, I just didn't want anybody to take over. Because the person who was driving before me saw the roads, because there was a Scorpio that was stuck there, and they couldn't go. So he saw the road, and then we were waiting. You know, we were waiting, and the road was closed. Not closed, we couldn't go past it because there's so much of slush. And then out of nowhere, a JCB comes, and they start pulling, you know, dry soil onto the road. And then the Scorpio was still stuck. And the person who was driving before me, he just came and say, he handed over the keys quietly and said, "You drive." You know, he just didn't want to attempt it. So my car has a little bit of a more clearance than the other one. Mine had a 19-inch wheel. The other one has a 16-inch wheel. That helped a lot. These are stock tires, stock wheels. And for some reason, the second car came from Tata and they had downsized it to 16-inch wheels. So that made a big difference. I had a little bit more clearance than the other car. That's one thing. And my Hexa was also in a better shape than the one that came from the company. Again, and because I don't let anybody drive it, I'm very possessive on Dhanno, so, you know, nobody really touches it. So I've been driving that car myself. So that was in a better condition than the other car. And people got off the car because obviously we had lots of bags as well. So we had weight in the car. So that particular stretch, I backed out a little bit more and then picked up momentum and, you know, traction. And I just didn't let go. There's a couple of videos on Instagram and videos and I'm fishtailing, you know, like crazy. But I just kept at it, you know, trying to avoid boulders and, you know, and all that. But at that point, I didn't expect it to be so bad. I would have gotten bash plates. I didn't do that. And I'm like, next time I'm doing something like this, I need to get bash plates under the car, which like completely slipped my mind. That's another thing I would take a precaution of having when you're going something like this, to get, you know, bash plates under your car and that sort of thing. But I would tell people to go get 4x4 lessons, you know, to handle this sort of terrain. Yes, that would help.
In fact, there is one off-road academy near Mumbai.
Right.
In a place called Igatpuri that's run by Mahindra.
Yeah, Mahindra does it, correct. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that is something which I think off-road enthusiasts can definitely think about. And how do you kind of work with the clutch and the accelerator? Do you let go of the accelerator fully and just...
Okay. Let me quickly tell you, both these cars are automatic. So both the cars are an automatic, no rear wheel drive cars.
Is it tougher then? In the automatic, you have lesser control.
Yeah, so that's why I had to back up a little bit and then gain momentum and not lose traction as I go up, because it's very slushy and you could get stuck. So, and for us, getting stuck is something that we can't afford to, because for anybody to get to, we have Tata Motors in Nepal and they helped us service the car while we were waiting for the papers. We had the car serviced and washed and all that. But for them to get there, they will still have to travel the same road to get to us, which is going to take 2 days and we don't have that time. So I was like calling all the gods that I can think of, and then, and also like a bit of a swearing, you know, as I got in there. It was crazy. So like I said, it's an automatic. Both these cars are automatic. Yeah. Who's even harder?
So next vehicle which you ever buy, that's going to be a manual with a four-wheel drive.
I have to. Definitely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Because definitely we're not ending XPD here. There are going to be more editions of XPD as we go.
Absolutely. Every year, hopefully.
So you've gone from Nepal, you've entered Tibet. From here, you've entered Russia, is it?
Yeah, Russia.
Were there any countries that you crossed en route or directly?
No, it was just four countries. Like I would say five, Tibet and China. But, you know, that's another thing. In the car, we had put Tibet, China. So people there were offended when you enter into mainland China. We had only the China flag. We didn't have the Tibetan flag. So that's a saving grace, you know. So they don't like Tibet. And when you can't say five countries. So I was India, Nepal, Tibet, China and Russia. That was what the map on the car. But they didn't like it. They kept saying this is four countries, not five countries. You know, they're very open about it. They come up to you and tell you and go, the Chinese, wow. You know. So yeah, we faced a lot of that. But it was only four countries.
So once you entered Russia, how was it like now? I mean, the landscape would have changed a little?
Drastically. It was all flat land, completely flat, aloof, desolate. Vladivostok is really nice. It's a nice city. But then once you leave Vladivostok and go, the Trans-Siberian is very, very desolate. For 200 kilometers, there's nothing. Fuel, I believe it's better now than it was a few years back. People have driven a few years back, told me that you need to carry fuel with you. We had jerry cans, but we didn't use it because there are enough pumps than it was before, you know. So that has changed a lot. But very, very beautiful. And fall was just, autumn was just happening. So the colors were changing. But very stark, I would say. Some places, very, very flat land. Except for the last bit, the Ural Mountains, where it's a little mountainous. Most of it is flat.
But nothing will compare with Himalayas because they're the highest mountain ranges in the world.
Absolutely, and absolutely. You're just,
you go all the way uphill, come downhill, and then you're in the plains after that.
I'm very stark, the contrast, you know, like from where we were and all those high passes to just flat, boring land, I would say, you know, very different, very different.
How was the culinary experience on this trip?
Okay, for me, it's a very difficult question. I mean, not a question, very difficult because I'm a vegetarian. So I did carry food with him, but I still like to try local. So I ate whatever I could. You know, it's very typical when you enter Russia from China, rather you see a lot more of a Chinese influence, like the dumplings, you know, that sort of food. So then they did have a little bit of a potato dumpling or a mushroom dumpling sort of thing. And then as you go, there's a Mongol influence, and then they have some pancakes, again, momos, and a lot of horse meat there.
Yeah.
And then when you get closer to Moscow, then it becomes a little European. So you see samosas, they call it samsa. So I'm told that the samosas were actually originated from Russia and Central Asia. So that's something that I learned on my last trip, but I haven't really checked up on that. But it's called samsa. It's still called samsa there. So you see a little bit of that, but again, all meat filled. So you really have to look to see if there's anything vegetarian. And with the language, it's impossible. With Google Translate, we can try to communicate a little bit, but it's very hard. So I did try a little bit, but the others had a great time. The food, they enjoyed the food. Very different for them. Everybody was adventurous, so they were all trying the other food. But for me, it's a little hard. I carried food with me, dehydrated food. So I ate a bit of that, but I did try locally also, like vegetables and some potatoes. Basically, they have every form of potato. I've been speaking about it. So like mashed potato or fried potato, whatever. So, you know, there was one point in China. This I must tell you, we were in a city and they had Pizza Hut or pizza. So we go to pizza. We got very excited seeing Western food. So let's do pizza. So we all go. And then we look at the menu and they have a margarita pizza, but they don't sell it. It's there. It's there on the menu. So I keep pointing to it. And she said, we don't have the ingredients to make it, she says. I'm like, what do you put in it? It's just pizza and pizza base and cheese. Can you believe it? I didn't get a margarita pizza in a Pizza Hut in some city in China. I mean, it's that bad. She kept saying, we don't have the ingredients for this pizza. And that's the only vegetarian thing on the menu and they don't have it. So it is very bad in China. And then, of course, you get rice, which is a, you know, lifesaver, you know, and I've had some puddies and chutneys. So I manage with that. And of course, noodles and that sort of thing. But China was easier than Russia, I would say. Russia is just meat and potatoes. There's nothing in between.
And it's very desolate, so they can't really grow too much of green vegetables. And
exactly. And it's very cold, you know, like they only can farm for 3 months and then the potatoes stay that long. So otherwise, the rest of the time, it's so cold and nobody even gets out of homes, I think, to do anything. Forget farming. So it's, Siberia is so desolate. It's they really don't have other choices, really.
Yeah. So how many days was it in Nepal, how many in Tibet, and finally, how many in Russia?
So it took us 6 days to cross India from Coimbatore to Gorakhpur. And then we had about 6 days in Nepal we reached, and then 5 days in Nepal. Russia was from the 7th September to 27th, which is 20 days.
Wow.
And the rest of it was in Tibet and China.
So this Russia trip, tell us more about this route. I mean, it seems like a very straight line, but I'm sure it's far tougher than it sounds.
I would also like to tell you that we had a really bad experience entering Russia. When you need to start Vladivostok, the closest port was a place called Kraskino. Okay, so this port is not a commercial, I mean, it's a commercial port. It's not for passenger car, but it's been done before. Passenger cars have crossed over before. And they had, 10 days back before we went, there was a German car that went through and all that. So, and I had done my research, and what they tell you is you can put your cars on a truck and you get your papers, treat it like a export and import into Russia. Do that and you guys just walk across and then your cars across and then it's treated like a commercial thing. It's not a passenger thing. So that's what we did. We got a flatbed, put both the cars on it. And drove it across. I mean, the driver drives it across while I and my brother sat in the cabin. And the rest of the passengers, rest of the people were just walked across the border and they were waiting for us. So we did that, like how it's been done before. And we were stopped at the border saying, you can go ahead. And the cars can't go. You don't have enough papers. But we did have all the papers. a complete set of papers. Everything was there. We had the carnet, which it's not useful for them, but we had the export-import papers and all that. It's been done before. And the lady, we have a couple of them at the... And it's not like it's a busy thing, you know. It's a small, it's a very small, you know, shed kind of thing. And it's raining that day, you know, bad weather, and we're cold. And they say, you can go. Yeah, we got our passport stamps and you can't take the cars because you don't have papers. And they refuse to tell you what papers also. They kept saying, niyat, which is no. Bad paper, go. Bring paper, go. Go. That's all they tell you. So we begged and we, you know, tried to talk, tell them. I mean, at least get them to tell us what paper. Did not happen. So we left the car there.
Mm-hmm.
And so our cars were in no man's land. The thing is, the cars can't go back into China, you know, because there are no papers for it to go. I mean, it's once you exit China, it's done. So it's a no man's land, basically, between China and Russia. There's a little bit of a room and the cars were parked there in the truck. The driver was in the car. And we made it to this town, which is about 50 kilometers from the border on a bus. And we reached there and then we tried to call the embassy and said, look, this is what we want. So they sent somebody and basically they sent a wheeler dealer kind of person who will talk a deal to these people and, you know, get our cars through. This was on a Saturday. So Sunday we had to wait. And Monday morning we went to the border. We couldn't go. There was a local Russian young man who came and, you know, to try to do the, you know, the deal. So he went and then he spoke to them. And then that evening our car was released. We had to shell out some money with nothing, no papers signed, nothing. We were just asked to leave, taken the car and you can go. So wow. It was a very not so nice experience. But yeah, it's when you ask people, they say, oh, this is Russia. It happens, you know, it's very common, you know, that it's okay with them. Things like this happen. They kept the car for no reason, just for some money, you know. And which we did pay up. And yeah, and we are let through the car. We didn't even have to go pick up the car. The agent went, brought the truck and then offloaded, loaded it and gave it to us. And then we drove off. But then we lost 3 days there, which was quite unnerving because till the agent showed up, you know, and because of the language, you can't really talk to them. And they refuse to tell you. They're very rude. They don't even tell you. They just say, no papers, go. No papers, go. Go, bring paper. So you don't know where to go and what, ask for what, where to go for papers. We don't know what papers we're missing.
Mm.
So that was a really not nice experience. But yeah, it's a good thing to talk about it because we don't want people going there and getting stuck like us, you know.
So it's good to have some kind of a connect with a wheeler dealer in Russia before you enter.
Absolutely. And this was the same person who, I don't know if you heard of Mr. Suresh Joseph. So I called him also. He's the one who did the Trans-Siberian before me in 2014, if I'm not. 14 or 15, I'm not sure. So he did the Trans-Siberian and he had the same problem. So this same guy, Anatoly, did the wheeling dealing. So we took the contact from him and called him and the embassy also connected with him. And they sent him and it's good to have somebody.
Okay, so we have crossed the border. We have got into the cars now. And they're all okay. Now take us through the journey. So what are we doing here for the 22 days?
Yeah, so we reached Vladivostok and that, you know, Vladivostok, we were there for 2 days, supposed to have been there for 2 days. But because we lost 2 days here, we didn't stay those 2 days. We kind of, you know, readjusted our itinerary. And next morning we had the cars serviced. We went to a Castrol dealer and we had all both the cars serviced and wheels aligned and the air filters changed. We did all that. And then that afternoon we left to the next destination. So, and every day was... It's a lot of driving because there are a couple of days we did 1,000 kilometer stretches because there's nothing in between, no towns to stay, no hotels or no motels to stay. So you will have to drive those 1,000 kilometers or 800 kilometers or 700 kilometers. So that's how desolate it is. Like when I plan the trip, you look at cities that you can stay in, you know.
Yeah, that's the only way to do it.
That's the only way to do it. Or you sleep in your car, but with 8 people, you can't really sleep in your car. It's not safe also to do that in Russia. Mm.
Yeah.
So we did long stretches and then we lost one more day that we were, because of those 3 days that we lost here, one more rest day we had to drive. But we saw a lot. We saw the Lake Baikal. We were at the Lake Baikal. It's something that I knew it was big, but the size of it really hits you when you reach there because you're driving along it and you're driving and you're driving and the lake is still there. It's like an ocean, you know. It was fabulous. Something that I read in my geography books and then I'm seeing it this time. It was so nice. Lake Baikal was something that I really wanted to see and I got to see it. And we had a really good time on the in Irkutsk and we drove down. It was nice. We saw a lot. Whatever there was to be seen, we saw. We didn't miss all that.
So on this trip, Meenakshi, I mean, with a 8-member team, there are going to be very divergent viewpoints on Absolutely. Certain decisions that you have to take. So right. how do you manage a team like this of 8 different people? Some of them might have met each other for the first time.
Absolutely.
So how was, you know, managing this entire expedition?
Yeah, it was not easy at all. I think that's, again, my hardest part, even in my first trip, this trip also. To keep it all together is quite difficult because everybody wants... So like even for your, you know, your bio breaks, you know, people want to constantly stop. That's one thing, you know. But we kind of got into this routine that we would stop every 2 hours sort of thing. And food. The food is like, if I get hungry, we can't really stop because there's nowhere to stop. So there are only few places we could stop. You know, there's only here you can stop and everybody has to eat. If it's you're hungry, not hungry, then you eat your food there, that sort of thing. So that was easy that way. But most of the decisions were taken by me because the hotels were all researched by me, booked by me. I didn't really take opinions because if you start taking opinions, then it becomes too much. So yeah. that's some of the decisions were completely taken by me and my brother, maybe. Regarding the car, it was completely me and my brother. You know, anything okay. that's to fueling and that sort of thing. And even the driving, when people are not driving, speeding, that sort of thing, then we say, okay, now this is not done, you know, sort of thing. Do not use your phone when you're driving. Do not take pictures when you're driving, that sort of thing. So all mm-hmm. that was, all those rules were put in place even before we started. But we kind of, it was a very nice group. People were willing to, you know, want to learn, even if you're not, when you tell somebody don't drive this way, then they're willing to learn. So that part was not hard. But yeah, it is difficult. Again, stopping this breaks thing, you know, somebody might want to take a picture somewhere. Yeah. And the thing is, traveling by myself or 2 people is very different with 8 people. 8 people getting out of the car takes up 5-7 minutes, you know, because you're gathering your stuff, you know, your jacket, your that, your camera and all that. And then doing your thing and then getting back into the, you lose about 1 hour, 1 hour, 15 minutes for lunch or a meal, you know. But yeah. even for a photo break, people get off and then you get carried away. Somebody's going live on Facebook, you know. So it's a little hard. That was the hardest part, I thought, you know, to get everybody together quickly and keep going.
When the situation gets tough,
right.
some of the inherent negative qualities kind of also crop up. Were there any right. situations like that you felt at any point of time?
Kind of, yes. It happened a couple of times. You do get selfish and all that. But yeah, but that's something that happens. I think it's inherently, that's how we are. We humans, we tend to do that sort of thing.
But thankfully, the team was, you know, well gelled and, you know, they kind of were able to take each other through all this.
Had a little bit of it's not always smooth. Small things, you can get irritated because, again, like cabin fever, 4 of you in a car constantly. And then in the room also, you're sharing. None of us had separate rooms. So you're in each other's space constantly. You know, yeah. in your face, and it can, for 52 days, it's a lot. The only time you're by yourself is in the loo, you know. That's the only time actually you're by yourself. Or if you want to take a break, then you go for an early morning walk sort of thing.
Yeah.
But you don't, because you're so tired. Some of them did. A couple of them were like on the toes, going out in the morning, getting some fresh air sort of thing, which I couldn't. Because I was getting tired. And, you know, you're doing a lot. You do your Facebook posts, you do Instagram posts, you write your notebook, you write your logbook and all that. So by the time I had to get to bed at 12:31 every day, and then you're up and about in the morning. So I wasn't doing that. But some of them did find that little bit of a quiet going for walks by themselves. Yeah, it is a little hard. It's not easy at all. That's the hardest part of the expedition, I would say. In fact, touch wood, none of us fell really sick. Some of them had some stomach upsets here and there, but not like a very bad way. A little bit of altitude sickness. Some of them had headaches and a little bit of nausea sort of thing in those high altitudes, but nothing adverse that would, you know, would have brought us back and all that. So that, God has been very kind.
That's quite a story. 52 days on the road, and like you put it, you had no time away from each other. You're practically living with each other for 52 days.
In your face, like in your face. Absolutely. Like like I said, no, the only time you get is in the loo, that 15 minutes or 10 minutes in the bathroom. That's it. Absolutely. Yeah.
Because I think such trips, more than the journey, I mean, the journey is very important, but it's a journey for yourself. It's your discovery about yourself as an individual.
I think so too. You kind of mature. You become very wise, you know. It changes me from what I was to 2017 when I did the Coimbatore London to now. Mm. I've become more, you know, I would say more patient, more everything, you know. I've changed a lot. And I think all of us did, you know, we found ourselves. I mean, we also know our flaws also come to light. Everything, it just comes, you know, it hits you in your face. So it's very evident that we're all human beings, can be petty at sometimes, you know, we can be, and we have been also.
Yeah. So congrats, Meenakshi, once again on this amazing feat. So behind every such expedition, I feel there has to be that one pillar around which everyone can kind of, you know, revolve. Right. So right. It's important that you were there, and I don't see this such a success if you weren't there.
That's very
That's
sweet.
Understating the importance of a lead in any such trip.
That's absolutely sweet of you, but it's doable. It's not doable at all. It's quite doable. You just need to be patient and hang in there and just bite the bullet, and then you'll be fine.
Patience is one thing that trips like these really teach you, don't they?
Completely. You should ask Arvind, my husband, and he'll tell you how different I am.
You know, I wanted to ask you, how come, you know, does Arvind travel with you, or is it just you on solo trips?
No, we travel. We travel on family holidays, but he's not a road person. He likes to drive, but not like this. Nobody wants to get into the car day in, day out drive. We do drives when we go to the US or wherever. We do travel a bit as a family, okay. Me, my husband, and Vedika, my daughter. But nothing on these lines at all. This is something that he will not ever do. But I must tell you that he did go with me to Bangkok the first time.
Okay.
We did Bangkok. We did a 12-day drive with a company, a curated drive. It was from Imphal to Bangkok. That was in 2016, January. He was there on that, which he enjoyed, because it was not something like an expedition. It's something that somebody is taking you on. So, and you're driving when you want and everything's taken care of. There's no stress levels. Stress levels are not there. So he was very happy on that. And there were a lot of people other than myself and my face. So he went around and all.
So how do you compare such curated trips, you know, with something what you have done right now? I mean, there are positives to it and there are definitely some negatives to it as well.
Absolutely. I enjoyed that trip. I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it. It was a lot of fun, because there's no pressure on you to do anything, to execute anything. So that pressure was completely off. You're just there to drive and then enjoy yourself, enjoy the food. You kind of go from car to car even, you know, you can go to different cars. You meet people in the evening. It's this partying and all that. It's very nice to meet people and all that. But I figured, I mean, at the end of the trip, I had a good time, but I wasn't. It was not complete for me because I didn't do any planning. For me as a person, I'd like to do all my planning, put everything together, you know, make my own route. So that sort of thing that was completely missing, and that didn't work for me. I loved it. They did it very, very well. But for me, it just wasn't working for me because it didn't feel like travel. It was like going on a curated, you know, like food would come to your... Yeah, like a tour, exactly. So everything's there. You don't even have to order your food. You go for lunch, you say, we know where we're stopping for lunch. So you stop and the food comes out in 10 minutes. You don't even place your order. The food is fabulous. I'm not saying the food is not good. But then you can't choose what you want. You know, I get 3-4 dishes, like vegetarian. Food is vegetarian. Food is always there. But then it's just didn't click for me. But for a lot of people, it works. And because they don't have the time or they don't have the, I don't know what, but it works for so many people. It just doesn't work for me. It's not my thing. I as a traveler, like, I'm not a tourist. Like, that's my hashtag that I constantly use. I'm a traveler, not tourist. So there's a big difference between these two trips, you know, a huge difference.
So would you do this trip again on your own on Dhanno?
I might do. I'm actually having a few plans. I might do that, yes. But I've done it because when I went to Coimbatore, London, we drove through Myanmar, the same road. And it was very different when I went with this company, you know, very extremely different. We did Naypyidaw, we did all the Yangon and all that on my Coimbatore London. The experience was different. We were looking for places to eat, which on that trip we didn't have. So it's different, yeah.
Tell us about some of the other trips you've done. Like, you've done Baltics, you've done Portugal in a caravan, you've done Canada.
Yeah.
Were those also as raw as the XPD Beyond Asia, or was
Absolutely. My Baltics, I did Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. in 2018 in March. So I had 2 weeks, and my daughter was supposed to come, but then she had spring break. She used to be in the US, but she's back home now. So she was supposed to join me, but something came up for her and she didn't. So I went ahead and I picked up a Corolla, a rental car in Estonia, Tallinn. And then I did a 2 week solo trip by myself around these three countries. And I don't know, I can't explain. It was, for there were days together that I haven't spoken a word, you know, to anybody. And it was such a good experience. And I was doing things by myself, like I ate where I want. See, again, that's another thing when you go solo, you kind of do your own thing. You know, you eat when you, only when you're hungry, you don't have to worry about other people. It was amazing. And those three countries are really, really beautiful and totally safe. I was by myself. I stayed in Airbnbs. This time I used only Airbnbs, but only I made sure that they were full places, you know, like an apartment. I didn't want to share rooms sort of thing or a shared property, like two rooms, three. So I always took one entire property, like even if it's a two bedroom, it's fine, or a studio sort of thing. And I was completely fine. I didn't have a problem anywhere. Google Translate is there. You have your maps and you drive and you stop where you want to. You know, I had my own itinerary. One other thing about solo travel, Vineet, I must say that when you're with friends or with family, you only talk among yourselves. You don't make an attempt to talk to the person in the bar counter or the restaurant, you know, the waiter who's serving you, or somebody's just sitting across from you. You don't, because you're so engrossed in your own thing. You know, you're talking to your family or your friends. You don't do that. You don't connect as much. But this time I spoke to so many, my Airbnb host, the waiter, and then he would tell me, look, the food there is more local. Go to this, you know, this night place. Go there. This is, you know, it's more authentic, you know. So you get to know a lot more about that place and you talk to more people. And also when you're by yourself, people talk to you. I mean, it's they just talk to you. But in a group, they don't. I noticed on this Baltic tour. And it was amazing. And I want to go solo now. After 52 days, I want to go solo now. At least for a week somewhere.
How was it traveling solo? You know, there are a lot of solo travelers in India and globally. But I've always heard, and I've also heard it from solo women travelers, that they face issues. And it's a genuine problem. How have you kind of dealt with it? And what kind of problems have you faced?
To tell you the truth, I've really not had any problems. I've done three solo trips. One was to just Imphal Nagaland, when I went to the Hornbill Festival. I was there for a week by myself. And it was fabulous. I didn't have any trouble. And also Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, I didn't know the language. I was by myself. People are only helpful. There was no trouble per se. No, people try to talk to you. That they do. And it's not like sometimes in India, they get pushy. There, they don't. When you say no, and they just walk away. You know, they would want you to maybe buy a drink for you or something like that when you're sitting in a restaurant. But they're not pushy. So I didn't have any issues per se. And you say no, no means no. They understand it. It was fine. And Canada, again, I did a solo trip. I drove from New York, rented a Jeep Wrangler, and I drove all the way. And I came back. So that, again, Canadians are amazing, man. They're such good people. And I'm going from New York, you know, and it's just contrast.
Places that you have mentioned, I feel that inherently the people there are very nice, like Northeast.
Very nice. Yeah, very nice. Exactly.
I feel the people there are so nice, so sweet. Totally. They go out of the way to make you feel at home. And they know that, you know, things are very different there, from food, language, the way of living.
Yeah.
And they just try to go out of the way to make you feel at home. So
they're such lovely people, Nagaland people. And they're just very nice. Yeah, the Northeast especially.
Yeah. But this might be a little different if you say travel to, you know, other parts of the world. It may not be the case.
I've not had any bad experiences per se. No, it's like I said, it's been good for me so far. And hopefully, yes.
I think, you know, the message that you kind of carry, Meenakshi, is that I don't think gender has anything to do with solo travel. That's something that I'm kind of taking from what you're saying.
Not at all.
So it's just about you as an individual, and that is about it.
I've met so many women travelers. Like when I said, when I went to the Hornbill Festival, there were so many other girls, you know. And there was a young journalist from Bangalore. Now she's in Pune. So she was there by herself. What happens is when you're traveling, then you start talking and then they kind of hang around with you. And you go out for a drink with them in the evening. It's very nice that way. And I'm thoroughly enjoying solo travel and I want to do more of it. The Portugal thing, like the caravan thing, was it was a different experience. I've never been in a caravan. I always wanted to. And I'm itching to buy one if they have one in India. They don't. I would love to do India in a caravan.
I've got news for you. So Scout My Trip just made a caravan.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's built on a Scorpio 4 four-wheel drive.
Amazing.
And it's got everything you can imagine. So yes, it's got like a working bathroom, toilet, it's got hot water, it's got a water purifier, it's got a kitchen, it's got
I'm going to come to Bangalore and have a look at it.
the camper right now is in West Bengal.
But
that's something that has taken around 4 years in the making, and one of our team members has personally kind of handcrafted this entire thing.
Oh, wow. That's something that I'd love to see and maybe even replicate. I've been looking for some vans, you know, a Force or something like a Tempo Traveler sort of thing.
Yeah,
but it's not happened. Maybe it'll happen this year, next year. I'm not sure. But Portugal was fun. It was a girl's trip with two of friends of mine who I've traveled with extensively. I've been to South America with them. I've been to Russia once before with them. So they're my travel buddies that I always travel with from Bangalore. So we did that, and it was a lot of fun. Like Portugal was, I mean, it's inexpensive. It's got everything. It's got the mountains. It's got, we went to Porto, we went to Lisbon. We did a lot. We drove about, again, 3,000 kilometers in about 12 days. And it was really, really nice. It was a fun thing, and I want to do something like that again soon, hopefully, some other country.
You spoke about travel buddies. Your daughter... Do you travel with her? I mean, have you had any kind of trips together?
Yes, we've done a lot of South America together. We did Brazil, we did Argentina, we've done Greece, a lot of Europe together. She used to live in Germany when she was in 10th grade. So then I visited, and from there we've gone. We've done a lot of travel in Europe, in the US, also when she was studying there. So we've traveled a lot together, and we're hopefully wanting to. She's back home for good now. She's finished her undergrad and she's home for some time. For good meaning, like maybe for a year before she takes off again. So we're thinking of doing something in January, do something different, maybe do, I don't know. We'll see. We're looking at some things.
Yeah. You've also been involved in a lot of social work. You're the managing trustee at the ARA Trust.
Yes.
Could you tell us more about what the ARA Trust is doing and how you're actually helping people out there?
So ARA Trust is a family trust, and I'm the managing trustee of the trust. What I do is I'm talking about cervical cancer, which is one of the least spoken about cancers in India, I would want to say. Rub it in a little bit, because in India, there's hardly any awareness. Everybody talks about breast cancer or lung cancer, other types of cancer. But when it comes to cervical cancer, there's hardly any awareness. The last year or two, it's been better. But compared to other countries, there is zilch awareness. And I've promised to do 100 talks this year. I've already done 25 of them in Tamil Nadu, on the four southern states. And not only that, from the ARA Trust, we identify girls who cannot afford a vaccine. So let me quickly say, this is the only cancer that can be prevented with a vaccine. So there is actually a vaccine to prevent this cancer. And nobody's aware of it. Cervical cancer is something that women get, children get, ladies get from a virus called the HPV virus, the human papilloma virus. So this vaccine prevents the virus from you getting it. So it's very simple. It's very straightforward. If you get the vaccine, there are 70 to 80% chances that you will not get the virus. And then which means you will not get the cancer as well. It's very simple. But then to put it out there, there's... in India, like if you look at UK and America and Australia, they all have this vaccine as part of their free immunization programs. In India, we don't. We have, I think Punjab has, but not the other states. So that's another thing we need to look at, you know, get your states to, you know, you talk so much about it, maybe they will take notice about it and make it part of their immunization program, like polio, like whatever the other vaccines that are available.
Yeah.
But other countries have done that. And also the vaccine is a little expensive and it has to be taken in three shots, you know, like three doses, 0 month, 1 month and 6 months. It's after 15 years of age for girls, after puberty, basically. That's when it starts working, works best at that point. So that has to be done. So I'm identifying girls because it is expensive. Like I said, it's about 2,000 rupees a vaccine. So for a girl, you would need 6,000 rupees. So I'm trying to identify girls, and I have vaccinated 33 girls so far, fully vaccinated. I'm having 10 done today. As we speak this evening, we're having 10 girls vaccinated. We have a small camp happening. I'm trying to do as much as I can. And Personally, I talk about this cancer because I know someone who was suffering from it and had a huge issue. And I said, if you can prevent it, why prevent the suffering? Why not? So it's easily preventable. It takes some money, yes, but it is preventable. So that's why I'm focusing on cervical cancer. Yeah.
So apart from the talks you're giving, are you also supporting the trust through other means, like through your trips or?
So Goldfish Trails is a small RR trust initiative. It's just taking its baby steps. I've started working on it and then I got carried away with my trip. Now that I'm back, I want to do some more work. So it's a small travel souvenir sort of thing. There are so much traveling happening out there. So if you, Vineet, have been to about 50 countries or you've been to 20 states in India, you can call and tell me, look, this is the list. And then you can have these engraved on rings and put on this keychain which says Goldfish Trails. And then you have these rings, which one small ring for each country. So it's like a travel souvenir thing. And I've been doing that a little bit and it's made on order. I put names as well if you want, you know, on the backside of the ring if you want, like your initials. Mm-hmm. I do that as well. It's custom made. Of course, the keychains are leather and they're all already made. They come in 5-7 colors. But the rings that go on it are custom made according to your list. And I've had people calling me saying I do only treks or would like all my treks on it. So I've done that for them. I've done states, you know, I do Indian states. Not everybody gets out of the country. So then you do. Mm-hmm. I've done states for, and then, you know, bike, lots of things you can play around with that. So I'm doing that. And it brings in a steady income to do these vaccines as well. And then there are very good, kind-hearted people there who give me some donations. And somebody from Coimbatore said, why don't you get 10 girls vaccinated and gave me 60,000 rupees. So I've been doing that also. So people have been very helpful there also.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going well so far.
So how does one order these goldfish souvenirs?
I do have a website saying goldfishtrails.com. You can look at it. And then, of course, Facebook, Instagram has its all of it. It's all there.
Lovely. So we'll actually add the link to Goldfish Trails on the podcast show notes.
Please.
So for anyone who kind of... listening to this can go there and place the order. So they need to place an online order. They can transact online.
Yes, they can do that. Yes.
Lovely. Lovely. That should make things a whole lot easier for people. So, but this is great. I mean, I think you're connecting that wanderlust that we have for travel and with something that's so noble as helping women and girls, you know, fight cervical cancer.
Yes, we need to fight. Yes, exactly. And it's very, very rampant. It's increasing in India. By the day, every 8th minute as we speak, one girl is succumbing to cancer, to this cancer. Every 8th minute, there are statistics out there. People look at it.
Why are we not talking about it?
Exactly. There's not much of awareness. Like there are a few hospitals in Coimbatore, few NGOs are talking about it. But it's always the pink ribbon. This one has a teal color ribbon. You know, the blue ribbon, it has a different color itself. So if you look at my car, it has the blue ribbon. Dano has the, if you look at pictures from this trip, it has the blue ribbon on it. So there is, we need to work a little bit more. And that's what I'm trying to do. Give back as much as possible, as much as I can do, like in this lifetime. So
more power to you, Meenakshi, for this.
Thank
more
you so much. You. Thank you. Thank you, Vineet.
One thing we really haven't spoken about is how are you, you know, financing all your trips? And yes, so what you, I know you, you know, run a beautiful place somewhere near Coimbatore.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us more about that? In fact, one thing I particularly want to know, because you're such an avid traveler, what are the learnings that you've kind of, you know, brought into this place of yours that, you know, kind of support the environment, the locals? Tell us more about that.
So Lakeside is what I run. It's a small boutique, very niche place. It's not near Coimbatore. It's near Dindigul,
where
I live. No problem. It's in the foothills of Kodaikanal on the other side. So it has a lake in front. And I've only had this property for the last 5 years. This is my 5th season. It's very seasonal because weather in Dindigul is quite hot during the summer. And season has just started here. So it's a 10 room or 5-6 cottages, 4 room sort of. I would not call it a resort. I would call it a guest house sort of thing because I only have 5 staff. It's very local. All the food is, you know, procured locally. We make our own bread sort of thing. It's very, very different. Cannot call it a resort. It's wrong to call it a resort. So it's a guest house or you can call it a
homestay.
Homestay sort of thing. So I picked this up. I bought this resort I'm saying resort again, this place, from friends of ours, a British couple who used to live here for the last 10 years. And then they were wanting to go back home to England. And I jumped at it and I said, I will buy it. And they offered, and they, I was the first person to offer that place because I've been there lots and we became good friends. I used to hang out there, you know, like I used to own the place and just go around, you know, spend a lot of time there. So they thought, okay, now she's the best person to have it. So they offered it to me and I jumped at it. It's spectacular out there. There's nothing there. It's just a valley and the hills behind and the lake in the front. And there are two other places like this, which is still run by foreigners. A Dutch couple run it and there's a British gentleman. So in the valley, we are only three of us. So it's a very self-contained thing. And, you know, if we have too many guests, if we are full up, then we send our exes to the next door. They do the same thing. It's very give and take. It's a very, and the village itself, Arthur, where it is, these people, the you know, when Westerners walk in, they don't bother you and all because they've seen Westerners since the 70s. So for them, it's just another thing. So they don't bother you. It's very clean village. And then we do also a village tour there. So when people come to India, we do, we take them to our local school. We take them to the paddy fields. We take them to the potter, to the sari maker. So we have a half day walking tour in the village itself. Which means we, you know, we pay the potter a little bit of money. We pay the, you know, so the village economy is also being supported that way. All our staff are from the village, trained there, you know, by the previous owners. It's very nice. And yeah, that's what I love to do. And living in Dindigul, you don't really see many people. But at my place at Lakeside, you meet a lot of people from across the world. You know, at one few years back, I was there and it was still owned by the previous owners. And there were 17 nationalities for Christmas that day, you know. So it was like, wow, you know, 17 different people from different countries were there. You see so much of, you know, the outside world in this little village called Arthur. And I get to interact with people. It's lovely. I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
That's so good to know. How are you kind of marketing this place right now? Are you listed on any websites out there?
We are on booking.com. I haven't really marketed it in India. All that's been done has been done by the previous owners. I've tied up with SOTC and Kioni, those sort of all inbound. La Passage in Chennai who sends me French guests. And this one in Calypso. There's lots of little niche boutique, you know, travel agents who send me inbound travelers, you know. We get a lot of people from Israel. We get busloads of them these days. Older, not the younger generation, the older generation. So, yeah, I've not really marked. It's still very raw. It's still very earthy there. We don't have polished granite and all. It's still basic brick, open, you know, that sort of thing. It's very basic. It's nothing fancy at all.
I think that's the experience, right? I mean, you're living with the locals and you're experiencing the culture. And you have such a great view and it's pure and raw. And
it's totally raw. We don't have televisions in the room. We don't have room service. We don't have phones in rooms. You to call and say, send me a cup of tea. No, you go to the main building, get your own tea. And, you know, that sort of thing. It's very, we've kept it that way. That's how the owners had it. The previous owners had it. And I've kept it that way. I've not changed anything there.
Yeah, because I think the moment we start doing all of that, the clientele also changes.
Absolutely.
And it changes the perception of what you're trying to do.
Absolutely.
You know, so it's great to know that you're kind of doing this without too much of marketing, because I think the word of mouth is really strong in these things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have good travel agent support. They've been there. The Lakeside has been there for almost 10, 12 years now. So they all know us. And it's also very typically between Madurai and Kodaikanal, or if you're going to Kerala towards Munnar also, we are there. So what happens if anybody who's coming to India on a 12-day or a two-week tour will come to Chennai, drive to Mahabalipuram and then to Madurai and then further proceed to Munnar or somewhere. So we're in the way. And all that is very touristy. They are like running back and forth. And here they just come and put their feet up, you know, chill. We have a nice swimming pool, good food. So they just do nothing. They just hang around for 2 days and they go on back to their, you know, touristy thing. So it's a very, if you look at the itinerary, that's how we are in between there, where there's, you know, a little bit of calm. Yeah.
Where the time stands still.
Absolutely. Completely.
Super. Meenakshi, I have learned so much from this talk with you. I just realized we've spoken just about everything about your trip, your past trips, your work. Is there anything else that, you know, we could have probably touched upon? that you'd want to kind of add from your side?
No, we've covered it all. We've done a good job today. Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Thanks so much.
It's been great. I haven't really spoken about this trip after I've come back. A couple of small interviews on radio, but nothing this in-depth. And I'm really happy. Thank you.
Thanks, Meenakshi. From my side, thanks for being on the show. It was really amazing to have you.
Absolute
Learned so
pleasure.
Much. And there's going to be a lot that we'll talk about. I'll add the links to Goldfish Trails.
Please,
so people
yes,
can
please.
Find out more about your work
in
the social space. And is there any trip that you're planning on next that you want to kind of tell the listeners? If there is one in works, do let us know.
Nothing in particular, but I am planning the Trans-Himalayan for next year. I'm not sure which month that will be in, which means I would be starting in Leh and coming down to Shimla, and through we go to Nepal and Bhutan and finish in Tezu, Arunachal Pradesh. That's something that I've been wanting to do for some time. So the entire Himalayas I want to drive. So that's in the pipeline, but I'm not sure which month. I don't know if I want to do it right after the road opens or wait till August after the monsoons. So, but that's something that I'm definitely doing next year. And there are small trips that I've not yet frozen upon or gotten. You'll be the first to know.
Thank you so much, Meenakshi. And I'm guessing that's going to be called Expedi Himalayas.
Absolutely. Trans-Himalayan. Expedi Trans-Himalayan.
Trans-Himalayan. Wow.
Yes.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Meenakshi, for that
Thank
scoop.
Thank you, Vinita.
And super having you on the show.
It really is a scoop. I don't think even my husband knows about it.
He's going to be very pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, or not.
All right.
Thank
Super.
You so much.
So we have come to the end of another great episode. It was great having Meenakshi with us. It was a learning experience. I personally learned a lot. Hope you did too. And if you like this podcast, do share, rate and subscribe to us if you haven't already. We are there on iTunes, Spotify, Google and wherever you get your daily dose of podcasts. So thank you and see you on the next episode.